I'm Alex Auerbach, and I'm a performance psychologist with experience working in the NBA, NFL, with elite military units, and Fortune 5 executives. I'm excited to bring you the Perform podcast, where we unlock and uncover the principles and practices of health and high performance for teams, individuals, and organizations so that you can be your best when it matters most. Excited to be joined today by Brian Levinson. Brian, how are you?
I'm good, Alex. Excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I am just excited to have the opportunity to put you in the hot seat after you grilled me for an hour for your podcast not too long ago. So this is a little bit of payback, but it should be fun. To kick us off, tell us about you and the work you've done. I know you've written a book, but you've also worked with some pretty high octane, high caliber athletes.
Yeah, so I found sports psychology because I was a lost puppy out of college and had no idea what I wanted to do for a living. So I worked in sales for a few years. And one of the people I interacted with during that time was a woman named Julie Ellion. And Julie introduced me to the field of sports psychology. We went to the Cheesecake Factory, had lunch. She said to me, "Brian, I know you love sports, and I think you have a unique ability to connect with people." And she knew at the time that I also love to help people. So for me, combining sport and psychology was an exciting proposition. So I went to grad school. I went to a school called John F. Kennedy University in the Bay Area and got my master's in sports psychology. And when I finished that, I got to work alongside Julie. So I think a lot of people in our industry don't have a mentor, don't have somebody to help them. I was really privileged. I know you're big on unfair advantages. Julie was certainly an unfair advantage that I had at the time. She's working with some of the best golfers in the world. Publicly, Phil Mickelson mentioned that he worked with her. And then there are a bunch that, you know, nobody has any idea about the work that she's done. So pretty quickly, I was getting access to some elite athletes that she didn't have the bandwidth for, the time for, or there were projects working with professional sports teams where she could use my help and my assistance. So I was really, really fortunate and lucky. And so anytime I talk about my journey, I think I always caveat it because Julie happened to be a family friend. And, you know, the word privilege gets thrown around a lot, but there's no question for me that I was really privileged to have Julie and privileged for other reasons. So I got working with athletes right away. Like the day I graduated from grad school, I was working with a pro basketball player and I just went at it. I started doing talks. I worked with high school basketball teams, lacrosse teams, hockey. I'd work at camps. I just hustled. And I definitely had some opportunities to me because I moved back to the Washington, D.C. area and I had a network that was there. I grew up in that area. So I just loved working with athletes. Over the last, I graduated in 2011. It's 2013. So math wise, I guess this is year 12. I've shifted. So a lot of my work today is actually in the corporate world. I still work with some sports teams. I'll still work with people in front offices or coaches, but I don't spend a lot of time working with athletes. Today, I work mainly with executives and in the corporate world, and I'm happy to get into that as well. But I'm grateful. My journey's been a pretty incredible one. I've had a lot of people help me along the way, like Julie and other mentors. So yeah, that's sort of my background.
Thanks for sharing. And yeah, I mean, even if we don't haven't named the mentors on here, right? I think all high performers kind of have someone that helps them get to that next level. I mean, the best athletes in the world have coaches, right? So there's a reason we need other people to reach our full potential. Appreciate the deep dive into the background. I want to start with just your ideas around high performance. Like, what is high performance to you and how does someone get there?
It's interesting. I find myself wondering about high performance and leadership. And I find myself wondering about the intersection of the two of those. And I think for the first 5 or 6 years studying high performance, and my book in large part is about high performance and separating your preparation mind and your performance mind. And so that's what I've thought about for a long time is I think high performance is having clarity about what you need in preparation and what you need in performance, and then setting up practices to practice both of those mindsets. Where I'm at today, as I'm wondering about this, I'm thinking about leadership because I think greatness is ultimately about making other people better. And I think the only way you make other people better is by positively influencing them, which to me is my definition of leadership. And not just influencing them, but influencing the team. And so for me, when I think of elite performance or high performance, it goes beyond execution and it goes into impacting those around you and impacting something that's greater than yourself.
Beautifully said. And I know I think a lot about leadership too. And I probably haven't as neatly put it into a model the way that you just did. So that's a cool one I can steal for myself. Talk to me about preparation mind. What does that entail and what are the skills you need to really optimize that?
Yeah. So I was working with a lot of pretty elite athletes, but I would, you know, one day work with a high school golfer. The next, you know, session would be with a pro basketball player. The next session would be a pro football player. The next session would be with a weekend warrior golfer or tennis player. So there was a diverse group of people that I was working with. But what I started to find the similarities amongst them was that they had clarity, at least the ones that were really maximizing their performance and fulfilling their potential. They had clarity about their preparation mind and their performance mind. So the preparation mind for me involves things like humility, involves things like work ethic, perfectionistic tendencies, using analysis or analytics, experimenting a lot, being uncomfortable. We always say be comfortable with the uncomfortable. I think that's a preparation mindset, not necessarily a performance mind. It can be focusing on the future, whether that's using visualization or goal setting. I actually think fear is something that can often be used in preparation and can be helpful in preparation. And then the last one I talk about in my book is being selfish. And so things like perfectionistic and fear and selfishness are words that we usually associate with negative connotations. But what I noticed and what I started studying once I went beyond my client base is that a lot of the best performers in the world leverage those. They just know to leverage them in preparation and not in performance.
So two follow-up questions then, because I think this gets at some of the heart of what I hear peak performers struggling with, which is one, like, how do you make those things helpful, right? How do you make perfectionistic tendencies, fear, selfishness helpful? And two, how do you turn it off, right? When you get into the performance mind, how do you make that shift almost like a switch so that you can let that stuff go when it's not working for you?
Yeah, and there's definitely negative. Let's just use perfectionism because it gets talked about a lot and people say, don't focus on perfection, just focus on progress. I don't know. I've been around a lot of pro athletes and then people in business and in other walks of life that absolutely are striving and setting high standards. And the high standards are like, you know, the highest of standards of excellence. And so I think it's perfectionistic rather than perfectionism. And so I think you have to be aware of that as it relates to your identity or our identity is, when am I going into perfectionism, which I'm using it for everything. And when do I have perfectionistic tendencies? And there's research here that shows that if perfectionism is adaptive, then that can really help us. So it's actually interesting because I talk about being perfectionistic in preparation and adaptable in performance. And the research will suggest that if you're actually adaptive with your perfectionistic versus maladaptive, then that determines whether or not that mindset is helpful. So if we're adaptive, then we're motivated on the job. We work longer hours. We can be more engaged at our work. If we're maladaptive, it can really backfire. And so I do think we have to be thoughtful about the words that we are choosing to use and associate with. And I do believe that if you study elite performance, let's just take basketball. We both are in those worlds and speak that language. Yeah. Like, you have to, the best shooters in the world have to make 100 shots and perfect their shooting mechanics and perfect their footwork. And there's an element of elite performance that involves attention to detail at the perfectionistic level. And when they're competing and they're performing and they miss their first 5 shots, that's where they also have to be adaptable. So I think for me, it's clean and it's clear, but I do think we have to be aware of when it's becoming maladaptive and when it's becoming negative so that it's not becoming a detriment, especially when we're performing or even getting into obsessive compulsive territory and in some other areas that could really hurt us both personally and professionally.
I love this concept of adaptive, and it reminds me of, like, I think a lot about psychological flexibility, and I know we've talked about that a bit in the past, but, you know, more and more of the data is showing the ability to deploy these characteristics, skills, traits, whatever you want to call them or whatever bucket they fall in. The more flexible you can be with them, the better your performance can be, right? Not all things work in all situations. And so what I hear you saying is there are times when this kind of perfectionistic tendency can really, really work. And there are times when it can totally backfire or get in the way of peak performance. And I think working on building the awareness around when works and when doesn't work is kind of the key unlock here for then making these tendencies work for you.
I almost called the book When. Dan Pink came out with a book called When, and his When was all about the time of day. But I almost called the book When and ended up calling it Shift Your Mind, which is probably a better title, I think. But the idea of when to me is so, so important for any performer. When do I need to be this way? And when do I need to be that way? And understanding that authenticity is not rigid. We all have these different aspects of ourselves, and we can tap into these different aspects of ourselves, but we need to know when it's serving us and when it's hindering us. So the thing about my shifts that I talk about in the book, if you take the preparation shifts like perfectionistic or like analysis and you apply it to the performance, I think it's going to be highly detrimental for most people. And I think the same can be said on the performance side. If you're just always adapting in preparation and you never actually build any routine or any habit around perfectionism, I'm not sure you're ever going to establish anything that's going to help you improve. If you're always relying on instinct, for example, in preparation, you're not going to analyze and study the game and be in your head to try to figure out ways to get better. So the book and my framework is really about the idea of when do I need to be this way and when do I need to be that way. And I want to be really clear about it. I focused on 9 shifts in the book. I had a list of like 37 of these shifts, and all 9 might not apply to all people and all jobs and all roles. So you might not need to be perfectionistic in your preparation depending on your job, and that's okay. But generally speaking, I was trying to make an argument that we need to shift our mind. We need to understand when something's helpful and when something is not helpful for us.
This is a beautiful concept of when. I mean, look, I think both book titles would have worked. So you probably would have been, it would have been tough to outcompete Dan Pink with his own title. So I think in that regard alone, you made the right choice. But the concept, I think, is really interesting because so often, as you know, peak performers, they kind of find what works for them. And then it's like, oh, that's what I have to do, right? I have to do that every time. I remember working at one point with an NFL player. And the idea was like, oh, I ate pizza once before a big game. So now I got to eat pizza every night before a game. And I'm like, I'm not sure that's the takeaway here, right? Like there are probably some other things that went into this peak performance, but it's interesting what people sort of latch onto. And so I love this concept of when do you need to use what? So talk to me about, I guess, how you help people figure out their when. How do we learn when and what for us individually?
Yeah, and so for that athlete about pizza, for me, it's all about curiosity before conviction. And so rather than have conviction that the pizza is causing me to play well, we know correlation and causation are not the same thing. So how do we discover what's going on there? For me, curiosity has become the thing. Curiosity and leadership are probably the 2 areas that I'm most curious about. I'm so curious about curiosity. I think it's so hard to learn if you're not curious. And I think curiosity unlocks our ability to learn. And especially in preparation, curiosity is a game changer. And so to answer your question, I try to get really, really curious with my clients to figure out what works for them. And if they think it's the pizza, so to speak, I'm going to stay curious and ask them more questions until we really discover what allows them to be at their best. And I think so often, even on this podcast, we're trained to be convicted before we're curious. We're trained to share our passions and our knowledge and our wisdom and our experience, and we forget to stay curious. And I know for me, I grew up in a house with 3 boys, a lot of arguments, a lot of conversations about sports, a lot of disagreements, a lot of fights. I really valued conviction and I really valued passion, and I still do, confidence. The older I get, the more I value curiosity. The more I try to stay curious, I find the better I am. And so where I start to go is to be really, really curious about where someone is, what they look like when they're at their best, what they look like when they're at their worst. And I think to be a high performer, if you can leverage that curiosity and preparation, like Kobe Bryant was big on this. His favorite book was Curious George. He talked about curiosity all the time. I love when people are highly curious, because to me, it's an elixir to learning.
I feel like we could go down a tremendous rabbit hole right now around conviction, and especially in sports, but maybe it's worthwhile to double click on, oh, I can't believe I just said that, but here we go. True podcast form. One of the things I struggle with a lot, so I want to get your take on this, is just how much conviction people have in the ideas that they believe. And I think this is especially true for people who have reached the top or who are performing really well. They develop this sense that their way just works and that it's the right way. And pretty soon it bleeds into kind of believing everything you think. And that's a really slippery slope. It moves away from that humility you talked about in the preparation mindset. It moves toward kind of rigid application of skills and strategies. Like, how do you help people actually build that curiosity and move away from conviction in the first place?
Yeah. And by the way, I think conviction is massive for performers when they're competing. Like, if I don't believe, I call it arrogance in my book. Once again, another word that people cringe when they hear. But I think when you're between the lines and you're competing against the best people in the world, like if you don't have this unshakable belief in yourself, the person across from you probably does, and it's not going to go well. And so I think curiosity is massive for learning, growing, getting better, improving. And when we get across the lines, a lot of times we need conviction. We need to say, oh, I know the offense. I know exactly what we're running. I know exactly my role. I know that I belong. I know that I can do this job better than anyone in the world. And it can often sound like arrogance. So for me, at least, I love binaries. I love the idea of polarity. I think we need both. I would just argue the curiosity should be primary to then allow you to earn the right to be convicted. We see this in politics all the times, in conversations with politics. I'm in Washington, D.C., so it's right around the corner for me. But like, we don't stay curious to learn about why someone voted for someone and why they stand for something. And if we do that, then we can understand them. It doesn't mean we have to agree with them. Empathy is a beautiful, beautiful skill to have. Doesn't mean we agree. I just need to understand them. If we're negotiating with someone, the biggest mistake we can make is to share our convictions and not remain curious. If we remain curious in a negotiation, we can probe, we can understand what someone else wants, and then we can work to get them what they want. That's the power of any negotiation book you'll ever read. So I give all that information to say, like, I don't believe that we should not be convicted. I'm curious about it, that we should probably stay curious a little bit longer, and then we can share our passions. Like, even as I'm talking out loud, you can hear me feel convicted in what I believe in. I don't think that's a bad thing, but I think it should start with a lot of curiosity.
I'll allow you to have your conviction around that, I suppose. I agree with your framing of it. I mean, I think believing in yourself, having that unshakable confidence, knowing you belong, I think those things are critical to peak performance. I think especially though for knowledge workers, people who are not in a space where there is often a need for that conviction, there's still a tendency to be overly convicted without enough curiosity. And so I just think it's a really important binary that you point out and an important kind of conceptual distinction to draw. Let's talk for a moment about people who are struggling or stuck, right? Suppose I'm in a slump. I strike out 15 times in a row, right? There's just no getting on base for me. How do you work with people or help people kind of pull themselves out of that struggle and return to that peak performance?
I wouldn't say it's my bag. I would not say it's like, I've had people come to me for the yips, and I usually say, look, like, that's not my game. Now I work with human beings that go through struggles and adversity. But for me, I'm not one to say, to troubleshoot, so to speak. Like, most of my clients are really good at what they do and they just want to get better and improve. So what do I do when they are struggling? I get curious. I ask them, hey, what do you look like when you're at your best? Have you ever been through struggles before? let's imagine it's a year from now and you've had a lot of success. What happened? Hey, what's currently getting in the way for you? So it's less tools and more curiosity and asking questions and helping them understand their process. So I think for that one, it's more inside out rather than outside in. Of course, there are things you can do. You can make a highlight tape. You can show them some truth and some stats and give them some examples and some shared experiences with other performers. But for the most part, I think it's about helping them think about it and think through it and imagine themselves down the road using their past experiences that they push through. But yeah, my bag is less. The phrase positive psychology, I think, is not a great phrase, but I love the idea of thinking about what people look like when they're at their best. And I think that's where I often am going rather than what they look like when they're at their worst.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate the candor, right? Like I appreciate the honesty about that not being your bag. So dead end for me, but still a good answer because you're sort of talking about
Alex, what do you do? Do you spend a lot of time with people in slumps and the yips or things that are really, really tough barriers beyond mental, you know, health, trauma type stuff?
Yeah, it doesn't come up a lot in the work I do individually, but it does seem to be a question people are often curious about. And so I've tried to reconcile or make sense of that as best I possibly can. But I have not yet figured out why that disconnect exists. Like in almost every talk I give, someone asks me about getting out of a slump. In fact, it happened earlier today. But when I work with individuals, I can't even think of one person who's come in and said, like, I'm in a slump and that's exactly what I need to address. A slump might be a product of something else going on. And so it's sort of like the outcome, right? It's the thing we see, but it's not really the issue. It's the observable piece. But in general, where I've sort of boiled it down to or landed on is first getting people to slow down or stop as the first step to getting out of a slump. So often there's a tendency when we fail to like overexert energy, become over controlling, to overdo it. And all the data points to that not being really that effective of a strategy. You know, there's data from like sports performance and choking. There's also data from like the corporate space where people kind of double down on their failures and then move too quickly and fail again, which I don't think is right. So I've sort of boiled it down to stop and slow down as step one, right? Sometimes you can't completely stop, but if you can, that's helpful. Step two, I think, is often to return to your baseline, like return to fundamentals and your strengths. You know, and then step three is to find like small wins and get some forward momentum going in the other direction. I'm not sure it's the right answer, but it's the answer that I've found that seems to work for some people. When we kind of talk about it in these Q&A formats, it's a tough one though.
I often have clients, this was big when I worked with a lot of golfers. I'd have them create an expectation scorecard. You know, golfers, they keep their score the entire round. It's pretty brutal. It's a brutal sport for a lot of reasons. It's also a great sport for a lot of reasons, but they would have a list of like five expectations that they had over the course of a round. So it might be take a breath every time before I shoot. It might be talk to myself in a useful manner. It might be to smile. It might be to grip the club with loose hands, like whatever it is. And so maybe there's a place for just being very process oriented and staying true to that process rather than focusing too much on the outcome. And you mentioned choking. I think Sion Bylock's book called Choke gets into a lot of that stuff and where we go awry when we think too far into the future, when perhaps we are creating physiological tension that can hurt us. But yeah, it is amazing. Whenever I have someone call me and say, I want Brian to work with our client and fix them, like that is a red flag for me. I don't come from that world of psychology, and it's a great opportunity for me to refer out. And I refer out to people all the time who love working with people that are really struggling. And so, yeah, it's an interesting place. I always say I get to work with amazing, incredible humans who are doing really, really great stuff. And hopefully I can just help them get to where they want to go.
Yeah, we all have got our place that we've kind of fit. And there's so much work to be done here on optimizing human performance and potential that, you know, everyone having their space to play and feeling good about it's really important. You've given me the entryway into my final sequence of questions here, which is, you talked about this expectation scorecard. I love the concept. I think it's great. You introduced the process orientation as an idea. For people who are just looking to get started in building their mental fitness, coaches, leaders, executives, athletes, whoever, like, what do you recommend as a starting point? What are two or three skills people should start practicing tomorrow to help them start to improve?
I find that question is harder and harder for me to answer as I do this work more and more. So if I've been doing this for 12 years, I'm trying to go back to how I would answer that in 2009, 2010, 2011, when I was in grad school. For me, the first thing that I remember back then was Carol Dweck's work around growth mindset. And it's just a very good primer to think about how we approach learning and growing and improving. And so I think that would be a good primer. I actually think the growth mindset is perfect for preparation. And I actually think the fixed mindset can be really helpful in performance. So I guess the second place I would go toward is this idea of, like, thinking about how you can shift your mind and thinking about what you need in preparation and what you need in performance, and make a list. Go make a list of, what do I do when I'm at my best when I'm preparing? And what do I do when I'm at my best when performing? And are there any opposites? Are there any differences? And get clarity around what it looks like to be at my best. And the last thing I'll say is, we all have experiences. Some of us have great experiences cooking a meal. Some of us have great experiences as a high school athlete. Some of us have great experiences playing the tuba. I mean, like, we all have these performative experiences in our life. I know for me, when I was in eighth grade, I gave this legendary speech to become president of our middle school. And I said, I may be small, but I have tall ideas. And I promised everyone that we'd get McDonald's in the cafeteria, which we did not get. I was a liar, I guess, politics 101. But I did get us an eighth grade dance, which was a big, big deal. And for some reason, girls liked me in eighth grade. They did not like me in ninth through 12th grade. My presidency did not lead to anything positive for me, for young Brian, but that was probably my prime. I was also a pretty good basketball player then. And then it went downhill from there. I say all that to say, like, we all have some experiences where we've had wins. And even when I work with clients today, I try to find out, hey, when have you had some wins in your life? And how can you apply your approach there to whatever it is you're doing now? And it may not be apples to apples, but I think we spend a lot of time learning from our mistakes, at least a lot of people that are on the path of trying to get better and improve. I'm not sure we always take time to reflect on our wins. And we have all kinds of different wins in our life. And I think there are really valuable lessons underneath those wins. And that eighth grade version of me, there's definitely some wins in there and some lessons to be learned that I sometimes forget about. Like, one of my favorite phrases is to think like a pro and play like a kid. And a lot of times we need to tap into our younger self. And a lot of times we need to think into the future and imagine. I have a client who says, I want to act like I'm an 85-year-old Southern gentleman sitting on the front porch drinking lemonade. Because he wants to slow down, to your point earlier. He wants to be more poised. He wants to be less reactive. And so we can put ourselves into these different states and think more about how we want to show up. Even just now, I just slowed down. I just paused. And I think we all have the capacity to do that.
Brian Levinson, this was amazing. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we wrap, tell people where they can find you and follow you and learn more about your work.
Yeah, so our company is called Strong Skills. And the idea of Strong Skills is to change the narrative on quote unquote soft skills. In the corporate world, things like leadership and emotional intelligence and communication are thought of as soft. And I came from a sports background, working in sports for a bunch of years. If you call someone soft, it's not a compliment. And so when I got more involved in the corporate world, I was like, man, we got to change this. This isn't going to work for me. So strongskills.co is where you can find us. The .com was like 50 grand for us to purchase. And I just didn't think an M was worth that much. So we went for .co. So strongskills.co is our website. I've got a podcast. It's called Intentional Performers. Alex Auerbach was one of our guests. He was tremendous. I highly recommend you listen to our conversation there, where I put him on on the hot seat, and he did fantastic. The book's called Shift Your Mind. You can find it on our website as well. And then Twitter and LinkedIn are the two places where I like to communicate with strangers. So you can find me there. Please be kind. Please be nice. But at Brian Levinson at both of those places. And Alex, this has been a blast. So I appreciate you giving me the platform. And the last thing I'll end with, I thought you were going to ask me what my unfair advantage is. So I came ready for that. And I'll tell you, other than like basic privileges in my life and family and friends and a network that I think put me on whatever base you want to put me on from a baseball standpoint, I was born deaf in my left ear. And so my whole life I've had one ear. And it's funny because there's that old adage, you have two ears and one mouth. And I always say, oh, well, I have one ear and one mouth, so I guess I have to use them equally. But what I would say about being deaf in one ear is that I've had to work really hard to listen, and I've had to work really hard to notice and observe people and try to get a sense of who people are beyond what I see. And so I think that even though it was a detriment in some areas of my life, it usually is an unfair advantage because I think I'm way more perceptive. I think I've had to work really hard to listen. And I think sometimes our unfair advantage can come from some adverse situation. And I think of like the Daredevil comic book character and his ability to act without being able to see. And I kind of think of myself in that same way, especially like the Ben Affleck version of Daredevil or the Netflix version of Daredevil or whichever show that was. But yeah, that I think we all have an unfair advantage, and sometimes it's actually a thing that we see as a disadvantage that actually ends up being our unfair advantage.
I could think of no better way to end this conversation. Brian Levinson, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Perform Podcast, where we unlock and uncover the principles and practices of health and high performance for individuals, teams, and organizations. Until next time, thanks for joining.